happy birthday. No birthday stations in, and I always like to say that means we're not getting any older. This is the monthly Thursday Informational Net Open Forum, or TIN for short. This net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and or other areas of general interest to those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. I do want to advise all stations connected that this net will be recorded for future presentation on our website as a podcast, and all stations participating will be part of that recording. Well, I want to welcome everyone this evening to once again our TIN, which is that South Cars Thursday Informational Net. We're going to talk about extremely high power radars, their antenna farms, and what their signals sound like on your shortwave radio. I want to thank everyone everywhere once again for joining us today. But with that, I'm going to throw this over to you, N070 from Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and thanks for allowing me to be part of your program.
K6SUN, N070, well, thank you, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be introduced and have you there tonight. Thank you so much. And good evening to South Cars, everyone on the net. So happy that you have joined us for tonight's Technical Information Network. Today's TIN is a special South Cars net because we will be using a slightly different format. We will use EchoLink for the net, so any of you that are on RL for regularly using EchoLink will, of course, be able to enjoy tonight's presentation. However, we are also using a multi-platform approach tonight. We will also provide for you to enjoy, if you desire, additional fun material in the form of web page addresses for you to look at during and after the net. Please note we are not referencing the user comments on those web pages, only the primary topic. The website will be voip.southcars.com, and we'll give you instructions later about how to access that page, or you should go there and follow the instructions. South Cars TIN hopes you will enjoy this special treat. We just would like to remind you, South Cars reminds you to practice good computer hygiene when accessing websites and to protect your own computers and devices. An up-to-date firewall and virus program are a must before you access any web pages anywhere. So, are there any questions? Please call N070. Over.
Romeo Fox Juliet.
Good evening, sir. W4FJ N070. Go ahead, Chief.
Well, this may be a stupid question, but does that mean I got to wear rubber gloves when I use my laptop? Over.
And shockproof boots also, Chief. Over.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Chief. I'm so glad you're here. We'll not be the same without you. Okay. So, any other stations with questions, please call now. Otherwise, we'll proceed. N070, over. Okay, nothing heard. So, Gordon, I understand you have a special third-party traffic reading for the net tonight. Over to you, KY6V from N070.
I do indeed. And it actually came from you. So it's fourth hand. Stand by while I cue it up, KY6V.
I'm Craig Bass, a kindly enthusiast, George made me say that, interested in railroads, geocaching, and super radars, who has agreed to provide links to my research for NO70's presentation. I hope you enjoy today's TIN.
Okay, there you have it, George. KY6V, back to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your and Craig, has been instrumental to this as well. I also have some third-party traffic from another non-technical editor who's helped with the beginning of the program here. Her name is Mary Wolford, and she have some third-party traffic from her for the day. Please stand by for her. Give me 10 seconds. This is N070.
Good evening, South Cars. I'm Mary Wolford, a kindly neighbor's lady. George made me say that. I agreed to proofread today's South Cars presentation to help it from becoming too technical I hope you enjoyed today's CIN.
Well, thank you, Mary, for saying hello to the Annette tonight. Mary, you did help me early on with a lot of the technical things, like don't get so technical so people can enjoy it. Let me break for any questions from Annette, NO70. Okay, nothing heard. So let's continue. So South Cars, tonight we will be using a special audio and interactive format for today's TIN. Because of the significant time, effort, and contributions of so many people to this special multiple-platform TIN, it is only fair to acknowledge all of these people's contributions. The executive producer and South Cars net manager is Kathy K6SUN. Gordon KY6V is editor extraordinaire, chief bottle washer, and script scrubber. Backup net control stations and real-time producers are Chief Roger W4RFJ, who is the chief coffee pot watcher, and also the ever-patient Gordon KY6V is also a real-time producer. Additional editorial assistance by Craig Bass and Mary Wolford for their non-ham operator review. And contributors are Craig Bass, Slav U83QGN, who you may recognize from the Saturday SSINs, and the Public Commission Work of the IARU, and IARU contributor DK2OM. Acknowledgement is made for all publicly available website and URL links referenced under fair use. Website synchronization and support were provided by Steve KF5VH and Gordon KY6V. Chief Morale Officer is Gary KC2RMO. All I had to do was think of his recovery efforts when I needed an extra incentive to keep going in the long midnight hours of preparing for this conference. Special thanks also to all of the South Cars NCSs and South Cars members who have been such great sports with the pre-publicity for tonight's technical conference in the spirit of ham radio and our learning about our hobby, and to all of you who joined us via this net or the later podcast. Fair use has been made in this presentation of web pages and web-like resources, which are available to all radio operators and shortwave listeners and the general public over the public internet. Attribution of private photo, audio, and video credits are contained in the linked web page and server. Free domain government, academic, or publicity publications are attributed inside the published link. No intentional misuse has been made, and gratitude is extended for all resources used in this educational forum. So please go to the voap.southcars.com website if you are by a multiple browser-capable device, where you will be able to pull up the link files for today's TIN on the special reference page. First, go to the main website page at voip.southcars.com by clicking on the picture in the upper left-hand corner, then click on the Read More link just under the picture in the middle. Next, scroll down to the Reference Material paragraph at the bottom and click on the link, and you will then see today's reference material. Does anyone need any help? Please call NO70. Over. Well, I thought we had a pretty good technically astute group here. We obviously do. So, again, now that we got all the formalities and everything out of the way, so, again, South Cars, welcome to tonight's TIN. Let's have some fun. The types of high-power radar we will look at tonight are ionospheric, like HAARP in Alaska, over-the-horizon, and over-the-horizon backscatter, which use ionospheric skywave and groundwave propagation, and coastal radar. That's coastal, as in coast. We will look at how the radar returns are analyzed for hostile threats, the military surveillance and scientific purposes, and the concerns of the surrounding peoples and towns. On today's South Cars TIN, we take a look at the more factual and the more interesting, secretive, clandestine, and less mainstream discussions about ionospheric and super high power radars. We are fortunate to have an all-star support team during tonight's net of Gordon KY6V, who has had a long-standing interest in the Alaska HARP radar installation. Chief Roger W4RFJ want to acknowledge Slav's contribution, who is not able to be here tonight because of the time difference. And, of course, our production people who provide us additional content as well. Let me reset the link. Our very own Gordon, KY6V, has a long-term interest in HARP, H-A-A-R-P, I'll pronounce HARP during the rest of the program, and radar. And Chief Roger, W4RFJ, who has worked with military radars, and both know about pre-HARP military radar and research efforts. After Gordon and the Chief talk to us, we will go on a worldwide tour to visit and see international sites and radar installations. We will look at some of their control rooms and antenna farms around the world. So be sure and have all of your travel immunizations for you and your computer completed. You will need both of them, virus scanners and firewalls included. So, welcome, Gordon. Tell me, how did you become interested in the Alaskan radar? What does HAARP stand for, and what does it do, please? KY6V from NO70.
Hey, thank you, George, and hi, Chief. Good evening, everybody. Gordon here, KY6V. Well, it goes back quite a ways. I'm very pleased to be part of this program tonight because the discussion is, as we said, has been an interest of mine for probably almost 40 years. I first ran into this subject in the mid to late 70s when I first heard a very loud signal on the 20-meter band that produced a pecking sound. It was not too long before the signal was being referred to as the Russian woodpecker and rumored to be an over-the-horizon radar coming from Russia. This facility finally went quiet in the year of 1989, it being placed in action as an early warning system to identify incoming intercontinental missiles during the Cold War. My question then was, what is an over-the-horizon radar, and how does it work? And the program tonight will address that question. Let me buy a nickel. Now, right on the heels of this woodpecker in 1993, the United States Air Force, Navy, and others started building a large transmitter facility in Alaska. It was so large and complex that it took 14 years to become completely functional. At completion, it had over 180 antennas. Can you imagine that? On 30 acres of land, and the capacity of producing 5.1 gigawatts of power beamed at the ionosphere. That would catch anybody's attention. It was called HARP, spelled H-A-A-R-P, and that stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. There's a mouthful for you. Now, as this was unfolding, I had a lot of questions as to how this thing really worked. Investigation into the technical side found that 180 antennas were organized into 15 columns and 12 rows. With due consideration to spacing and transmitter power distribution, this produced an antenna array with a gain of 31 dB, decibels. Remember here that it takes 3 dB to double your power. So the bottom line equates to an ERP, effective radiated power, of 5.1 gigawatts and a transmitter power output of 3.6 million watts. Wow. Let me buy a nickel. HAARP was a target of conspiracy theorists. They claimed that it was capable of modifying weather, disabling satellites, exerting mind control over people, and it was being used as a weapon against terrorists. Such terrorists blame the program for causing earthquakes, droughts, storms, floods, diseases such as Gulf War Syndrome and chronic fatigue syndrome. The 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800 was blamed, and the 2003 destruction of the Space Shuttle Columbia was also on the list. Well, let's say this about that. Commentators and scientists say that the proponents of these theories are uninformed, because most theories put away far well outside the abilities of the facility and often outside the scope of the natural science. So there you have it, and that's going to get you into the program this evening. NO70 from KY6V.
KY6V, NO70. Thank you, Gordon, for that description of the mainstream and the more extreme views of Al Harper's views. You know, I think I want to stick around for the program. I want to hear more about this. So South Car's members and that, HARP lacked capacity and portability for the more active military involvement, and HARP cannot sit on a ship or single battlefield to keep us safe. More on that later. We also have to look for more conventional radar to protect us from surprise hostility. We must also have shipboard and ground troop radar for what ionospheric pulsing and over-the-horizon radar cannot do. So, Chief Roger, W4RFJ, is it true that the Navy ships used a more horizontal radar return? Will you tell us more, please, about when you were responsible for shipboard radar, how ship radar kept us safe during the Cold War, what the qualifications were to run the radar equipment, how the operators were selected, how and if the output power was adjusted, if the radar was used to cause interference to enemy radar systems, you know, all functions that HARP and OTH cannot do. But I think maybe shipboard and coastal radar could. I understand that you had extensive training in the Navy in these radars. So I need to hear more from you. W4RFJ from NO70. Over.
Well, thank you, George. NO70, this is W4RFJ. Hello, South Cars. I had to get that out of my system. I apologize. I've had too much coffee today. I cannot say that the Navy ships use more horizontal radar return. As you're probably aware, there's several different radars depending on their function, and also passive radar. I call them passive radars. The electronic warfare guys had antennas and special equipment that could listen to frequencies and identify different platforms dependent upon what they're transmitting and so forth. Let me grab a nickel. The shipboard radar that I was responsible for were mainly the air search and surface search radars. Of course, air search is used during air operations whenever we had to track helicopters or aviation going to and from the ship, and it was around it's in the UHF range at 400 megahertz or so. And then we had the surface search radar, which was mainly there for navigation, but we could also track targets on the surface of the ocean. So you know, whether they used horizontal or vertical polarization, we also had the SeaWiz, which looked like an R2-D2 with a Gatling gun underneath it, and it used a circular polarization. I mean, the antenna was actually spun in a circular way, and it would track the bounces backs, and it would even... bounces backs. It would be monitoring the target and the bullets as they leave the turret. Anyway, let's see. I'm trying to make sure that I'm not forgetting anything. Am I doing okay so far there, George? W4RFJ?
Yes, sir, you are. One question I'm curious about is if you're able to tell us about what the power output was that was required for the shipboard, and because of RF hazards, was there like a maximum guideline that was publicly available? Over to you, at WRFJ NSNR.
Well, I got to say that I'm not sure the exact power output levels. I mean, we're talking, well over 20 years ago, and they probably changed everything. I can tell you right now that most of the data that was collected either through the passive or active systems were shared through satellite. So you could actually get a picture of the entire world and the battlefield of the entire world, depending upon the resources from each ship, each aircraft, and so forth and so such. But I know they've gone to much more complicated radar since then. I'm trying to make sure I answer your question. The power output levels were normally in the kilowatt range or multiple kilowatt ranges. I don't think any of the equipment was capable of putting out megawatts. However, you know, you might think with the size of the tube that they used for the air search radar that it was putting out in the megawatt region. But, you know, we're talking about something that's a little bit bigger than a gallon of water, but made out of ceramic and copper. And it's pretty phenomenal, water-cooled, too. Let's see. Let me get to the rest of the points I need to make in this paragraph. As far as qualifications to run the radar equipment, of course, I didn't run the equipment. I had to fix it when it broke. So maintaining the equipment, you had to be trained in the electronics field, especially radar in the electronics schools. The operators, they're operational specialists, and they're trained to be a scope jockey, is what I used to call them, because their eyes were affixed, just like a lookout would have to watch out through his binoculars. The operational specialists use the repeaters, as they call them, the television sets that gave the targets and the range and all the information they needed to track them. The output power was not necessarily adjusted. We had ways of mounting or monitoring moisture, SWR, standing wave ratio, and power out, of course, but it was usually constant. The one thing that you got to keep in mind is they use a pulse repetition rate of pulses to extend the range or shorten the range, and the polarization, I think, more dealt with the type of radar you were using. And I think they use like vertical polarization for air search and horizontal for surface search. But that all I can say is, as far as causing interference, there's enough power there, and it's directed in a beam. And let's put it this way, up at Great Lakes, Illinois, when they first set up the first SPS-10 classroom / simulator, it actually worked quite well. The first sweep blew up every flash bulb on the strip outside of the base. So that can cause problems. It can be used to jam, but you got to understand too that they're building our equipment, our ships, our planes to not reflect back as much RF energy too. So that's kind of a way that they beat that off. So as far as functions that HAARP has and over the horizon radar cannot do, you've got a directed beam, and that antenna is rotating, and those pulses are being sent out, and as the pulses get bounced back, the equipment is measuring the time for the pulse and the direction it was received from, and it's some pretty complicated stuff. I hope that I was of help, and I guess, George, I ask for questions if anybody has one, and then I'll pass it over to you, W4RFJ. I guess I put everybody to sleep. Back over to you, George. Hope my greeting was well enough. W4RFJ listening.
W4RFJ N070. Well, I just want to make sure they heard your invitation for any questions. So South Cars Net members, does anyone have any questions for the chief? Because I've always wanted to know more about shipboard radars, but information was so hard to come by during the Cold War and Vietnam and Gulf War eras. It's a treat to have someone around who could fill in those questions for me. So do any net members have a question for the chief? If so, please call W4RFJ. This is N070. Okay, nothing heard. Well, thank you, Chief. I really do appreciate your being willing to share time with us and your expertise tonight. Okay, so South Cars TI members, let's move from shipboard radar to HARP and ionospheric radar over the horizon, abbreviated OTH, OTH backscatter radar, abbreviated OTHB, and then a coastal radar. Are there any stations present tonight that have visited a HARP facility? I know someone mentioned that to me on the net earlier. I hope that station is here tonight and able to call. So are there any stations that have visited a HARP facility? Please call now, N070. Well, nothing heard. Okay, so we'll now going to proceed. I hope that you have your supplemental page up from the South Cars website, and we're now going to start our whirlwind tour. There is a picture of the Alaska HARP installation at Link 1, if you would like to pull that up. And I'm wondering if any of you have been fascinated by an antenna farm and wondered what happened at that huge hidden forest of antennas out in the middle of nowhere. Is there anyone on the net that has shared that fascination? Please call N070. Over. Well, I think we must have a bashful group here tonight. So anyway, there's a picture of the Duga Woodpecker antenna array that Gordon was talking about, the Russian Woodpecker, at Link 1A. Any of you, like Gordon, that were ham radio operators or shortwave listeners back in the day, have any of you heard or experienced interference to your radio or TV reception in the days of the Russian Woodpecker? Did it sound like a picket fence or woodpecker inside your radio? Did you wonder what that unusual sound was? Anyone that would be willing to share their experience about the over-the-horizon radar interference on your ham radio or shortwave listening, please call now, N070. Okay, nothing heard. I wonder if someone has said that the fancy antennas at the end of your block are supposed to control the weather or control people's thoughts or actions, or is that a high-power transmission facility for use by overseas intelligence operations under the umbrella of international scientific collaboration, in other words, espionage? And we're also going to ask if these government radars that were pounding the ionosphere with radio waves are trying to affect even human behavior as well. So let's talk about the ionosphere. So exactly where is the ionosphere? Where is it? How far up? Gordon, will you please tell us more about how the Earth's atmosphere is constructed and at what altitude the ionosphere is located and some equipment that is used in a HARP installation? KY6V from NO70. Over.
Well, thank you, George. I'll give it a shot. KY6V here. The ionosphere is 37 to 190 miles. High, or just above the altitude that John Glenn's orbital flight, if you recall that. You can see an illustrated top-to-bottom picture of the Earth's atmosphere layers and where the aurora and other weather occurs if you take a peek at our Link 2 on the second web page that's posted. It's got some good information on it. The 2006 project configuration of HHRP was for 190 antennas, George, and Superpower radio signals transmitted a total vertical radiated power of 3.6 megawatts over the 192 antennas. I found that going through this re-review, if you will, there seems to be a little disparity between, is it 180 antennas or is it 192? But I'll just tell you, it's a bunch. Now, that's covered in some detail and very informative in link 2A, that's 2 alpha, on our website. So for those that would like to take this a little further, I would point you in that direction. There's a lot of discussion about secret purposes of the radar installations that make for some interesting reading within these referrals that we put on the website. Such as, are spies truly using the ham bands hidden behind the radio transmitters being sent up to the ionosphere? Well, obviously the answer to that is maybe the answer is yes, but probably no. George is going to tell us more about some of the mystery surrounding these antenna towers, how they bring people to our ham radio hobby, and some of the more extreme views and claims that others have made and claim. So, George, NO70 from KY6V in South Coast.
KY6V from NO70. Thank you, Gordon. You know, shortwave listening on HF ham bands can bring weird radio transmissions of audio and code groups that were transmitted to foreign spies, and they brought them into your home or your ham radio hobby. The unusual transmissions were common, especially during the Cold War. Many people, yours, this ham operator included, listened to the Voice of America and Radio Moscow broadcast, which provided opposing viewpoints and propaganda. In the days before satellite imagery and GPS coordinates, chasing antenna farms could be a road rally sport. For many people, it led to the old Voice of America transmission site in the East Coast Piedmont. Another antenna chase led to a view of the U.S. Navy's super long wave submarine transmission site used to send traffic to underwater submarines in Cheltenham, Maryland. That site used to be very visible across the Woodrow Wilson Bridge outside of Washington, D.C., with about 12 very widely spaced towers and antenna wires stretched between all the towers for wavelengths of more than 160 meters and even longer wavelengths. So are there any other NET members that have chased antenna sites that you found in your travels? You saw these antennas up against the night sky and looked. Anyone else done any antenna chasing? I'd love to know. Please call NO70. Over.
Romeo Fox Juliet.
Ned recognizes Romeo Fox Juliet. Go ahead, sir, NO70.
You know what? I think I just got ahead of myself. Wait a minute. I apologize. I got ahead of myself. Please carry on. W4RFJ.
No problem, Chief. We're going at lightning speed tonight as it is. Okay. You know, on the ham bands, interference from government radar and jamming transmissions to this operator sounded like a lot of buzz saws and whooping tones. But what was interesting as we ham operators listened during the Cold War era or in the 80s and 90s to these over the horizon was that the world was actually being shaped by these mysterious intruder radar and radio signals. A radar signal from Europe that sounded like a woodpecker and the splatter from Radio Moscow made some HF ham operation nearly unusable for decades. Ham radio operators and shortwave listeners wondered where the sudden and extremely wide noise was coming from and what they were used for. International broadcasts and ham radio worldwide were frustrated for years from the interference from these radar sites. Some thought of an engineer sitting at the control room and wondered about the person at the controls, especially if they were maybe over in the Soviet Union, how they came to be there, who they were as a person, Why is this person helping with a Soviet radar site? I wondered about the mysterious nature of these signals that seemed to carry no information, but were only these loud buzzsaw sounds. On the SSINet one Saturday, Slav U83QGN mentioned Russian over-the-horizon radars in a remote part of Russia some distance away from him, and one that's recently constructed and named after the town he lives in. A week or two later, I learned of KY6V's interest in the Alaska Heart Project, and with all of these coincidences, you know, over-the-horizon radar became a topic of great interest. So the question then came up, how many superpower radar sites were there, and were they much more numerous than the general population is led to believe? So a long list of the worldwide list of superpower radar installations is at link 3. And W4RFJ, I am glad that you thought of what you had in mind. W4RFJ, please come in 070.
Yeah, George, I apologize. I got a little bit distracted there. When you were talking about the VLF transmissions for submarine, and you mentioned the antenna that could be seen from the Woodrow Bridge, I actually was a teacher in the Navy, and I taught the operators how to operate the equipment that did that communicating, and in the process of that, we did a field trip to Annapolis, Maryland. Now, Annapolis, Maryland, in the middle of it, they used to have, I don't know if it's still active, but they used to have an LF transmitter there. The capacitance had itself stretched almost the entire, each leg stretched out almost the entire, I'm trying to think what to call it, not the diameter, but stretched out in several directions all over the base. So they could probably put a canvas over it and basically call it a tent. But one of the issues they had was people were becoming electrocuted because when they parked their cars in the driveway, the antenna transmitted on such a low frequency that the cars became capacitor elements. So when they left their car, they had to ground their bumpers. Just thought I'd share. Over.
W4RFJ in the group, N070. Now, that is something I had never thought about or realized. Yes, so good thing before the net, I did recommend you got your rubber boots on. It's interesting, and you were taught there. You know, it's interesting that after I saw those antennas myself in the 70s, I had no idea that I also worked at Cheltenham in the early 80s. So it's interesting that we have that in common, although it certainly has changed between your time there and my time there, and, of course, to today. Any other stations that have visited a high-power or extremely low-frequency radar site? Please call in 070. Over.
Romeo Fox Juliet with additional information.
Please go ahead, Chief. Over.
Let's see. We went into the transmitter, and we witnessed the pre-driver tube was the size of, I would say, four 12-volt batteries stacked in a as close to a square as you can get. That was your pre-driver. The output tube actually had its own vacuum pump. They had two sets of each, and you actually, to do maintenance on the tube, they would let go of the vacuum and open a door, and people would go in, do the repairs, and then close the door and recreate the vacuum. The output tank was on a form of non-conducting material that I would say would probably fit a nice size house. But anyway, that's all I got. See ya.
W4FJ, you know, 7-0. Thank you, Chief. That, you know, with these frequencies of wavelength transmissions and the radar, it plays right into the over-the-horizon and ionospheric. So let's take a look at it. there's a video that is playing the sound of a possible combined radar and jamming signal that was received in a western desert area of the United States. That is at link 4. Please notice the three waveforms in the picture compared to the three sounds. It's posted at link 4. I'm going to pause about 15 seconds on the net here for those of you that are clicking the link. This is NO70 pausing for 15 seconds. This is NO70, and this is the South Cars Technical Information Network, where we are sharing knowledge and experiences with each other that relate to our hobby and our interest in electronics. So from that link, by the way, during this program, you're not going to have time to listen to all of the links, so you may just want to make a note of the link number that you're interested in and come back to it after the program. So using these, like you heard in link 4, or similar secondary return radar signals that are deflected from the ionosphere and back in scattered returns from the ground, we can ask, can over-the-horizon radar be used to see over the horizon, examine ground surfaces, identify tunnel entrances, and possibly analyze the internal corridor that satellites cannot see? In other words, can we find out where to send people on the ground? A primer on possibly using ground scatter radar to look for underground facility entrances and underground corridors at long distances is posted at link 5. When you pull that link up, you'll see a long document. If you'll go down to section 2.1.4, it talks about placing corner cube reflector devices, kind of like those janitorial wet floor things, to reflect EMF and their covert placement challenges. How do you get them into a place where you don't belong? If a pattern of signals can be reflected back to the entrance from these possible hidden devices, it may be possible to know the internal passageway construction, and from that passageway construction, the nature of the facility, whether it be nuclear, defensive, storage of money and assets, or some other governmental purpose. Section 2.3 in that document may hint at RF sampling of underground tunnels for length and opening width. It mentions optical, IR, and radio wavelengths as a way to determine the type of facility that you're looking at using the over-the-horizon radar. If we combine this with the laser-reflected cues from above, mentioned above, can we then combine all of that with very sensitive supercomputer analyzed backscatter radar radiation to determine the underground entrance ways? Well, there has been a lot of controversy about the side effects of high-power ionospheric and over-the-horizon radar emissions that look for these entryways and other targets, and effects mentioned but not proven or denied by authorities include earthquakes, radiation damage, weather modification, and human behavior control, as Gordon mentioned earlier. So for the effects of radar in humans, do superpower radars actually control human behavior by showering everyone else close to the radar with RF bounced off of the ionosphere? Or can they control international events by controlling the weather? Chief, will you tell us more about one of the notable individuals with a more extreme view of the harmful effects of ionospheric heating by HARPS? W4RFJ from NO70.
NO70, this is W4RFJ. I'd be glad to. An individual, Dr. Nick Begich, who is both the son and brother of a U.S. senator and a U.S. representative, explores some of the less believed concerns in Link 6. Possible damage to the Earth and its ionosphere, and the possible use of HARP to send electric power without wires, that sounds something like Tesla, interfere with communication networks, modify the environment by modifying the atmosphere, and interfere with human thinking and physical well-being is examined at length, or in depth, at Link 7. So give you guys a chance to check out Link 6 and Link 7, and I'll turn it back to George NO70 for a discussion of the research out of Latvia.
Thank you, Chief. W4MJ from NO70. Okay, so fellow South Cars TINNet members, one of the most scholarly treatments of the effects of high-power radar emissions like the HARP installations and the over-the-horizon radars comes from the country of Latvia with its own Skrunda-located radar station. Link 8 has more information. A more factual historical perspective is offered there in a very informative discussion of that radar installation. A History of Latvia by PhD candidate Maris Gomanis includes an impressive compilation of worldwide super high-power radars and discusses the Skrunda radar that was in operation from 1967 to 1998. Skrunda was a secret until it became operational, and when it did, it interfered with nearby civilian radio and TV reception. It was secret until it blanked out all broadcast TV and radio in the area with crosshatches and reception blackouts that gave away the presence of the new radar facility. What is most impressive about Dr. Gomanis' historic website is that Dr. Gomanis also details reports of blue-green lights appearing over the radar installation, strange sounds heard over the radar site, and perceived impacts on health by the local residents. Dr. Gomanis also reports a study by naturalist Dr. Valdis Valogis of scientific, and I forgive the any mispronunciation on that, of a scientifically proven negative impact on pine tree growth. If radar can negatively affect pine tree growth, can radar also have an effect on the human body, which is also an organic definition? Now, personally, I doubt it because of the difference in size, but the study by Dr. Verlotis did show a biological impact, however. There is more information about the Skrunda site in Link 9. Concerns about the harmful effects of over-the-horizon radar and other high-power radar have led critics of these high-wattage radars to express security and international concerns that others do dismiss as unfounded. The BBC has reported, however, that researchers have found a possible link between atmospheric disturbances and natural phenomena like impending earthquakes. Link 10 will detail more about the possible link between ionospheric radar and impending earthquakes. There are numerous sites playing a video about the Navy's sending a HARP radar to North Korea to create earthquakes and tsunamis in Link 11. Has this practice of the Navy added to the recent tension between the U.S. and North Korea? Choose the video link picture with the red and white play arrow that is the second picture down in Link 11. When you click Link 11, scroll down to the second picture down, and you can click on the play button there and see more. Of course, you can, again, do that after net as well. So are these impacts on people and places real as claimed by the critics? Well, the answer is not definite. It's certain that these radars provide real-time information on changes in the ionosphere that can be used to detect solar storms, enhance radio reception and radio astronomy from far away galaxies, and test means of detecting hostile aircraft or missiles by laying the groundwork for looking over the horizon so OTH threats can be detected. Gordon will talk with us more about the security concerns and events at some of these installations. It's a fascinating story. Gordon, please tell us more. KY6V from NO70, over.
Well, thank you, George. You know, it's an ongoing problem, I guess. It's just the way the world turns. KY6V here. There have been break-ins at these radar installations. Radar installations are usually secure, not always generally known facilities, but They may be operated in the open or hidden away in remote areas for different types of operation. Interesting write-up can be found on our website link page under link 12 that tells you some of the stories on people breaking in, climbing the fence, standing on top of silos and blah, 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 blah. However, sometimes neighbors get frustrated with the presence of the radar facility and can and do make their displeasure known. I guess people do that. There's an example of an official report, among others, that includes one of the security encroachments by neighbors on a Minuteman nuclear missile site. And this was in 1986. That information is detailed under link 13. The basic security incident report can be seen also at link 14. So there's, for those that are interested, a lot of information on who shot John and why. KY6V, back to NO70.
KY6V from NO70. Well, thank you, Gordon. And I think those are fascinating reading and a little bit scary since it dealt with the Minuteman sites. But, you know, taking a radar site out of commission can be a little bit dangerous as well. So I appreciate the South Cars TIN net members that are joining us tonight for this TIN. So, you know, some radio installations are public knowledge and some are covert or clandestine. Now, like Gordon just was saying, sometimes they're easy to see, sometimes they're not. There's a difference between covert and clandestine operations, you know, like HARP and over-the-horizon radar, and the jamming of radio transmissions by these sites have been both open and closely held secrets during their life cycle. HARP in Alaska currently is reported both as non-operational and at the same time of being active, open, and accessible for anyone to do research. So which one is it? Other operations such as jamming and radar facilities are closely held secrets about their locations and about their capability to interfere with or monitor foreign countries' operations, and they may be either covert or clandestine. Now, what is the difference between covert and clandestine? The difference between a covert operation and a clandestine operation is that the covert operation of a radar seeks to hide the identity of the operation sponsor, while the clandestine operation seeks just to hide the operation itself with the knowledge that after the operation, it's probably going to become publicly known. A public CIA document describing the difference between covert and clandestine operation was scheduled for tonight's TIN, but after accessing it during research, it became inaccessible on the web the day after I accessed it. That's link 15, but you maybe can use the alternative link, but you won't be able to pull it up because it was removed. If properly conducted, a clandestine operation of an over-the-horizon radar or ionospheric radar remains totally concealed. The authorities in the target area never know that anything happened. A covert operation, on the contrary, must have a product. Maybe, for example, a raid. For this reason, the government, military, or commercial agency carrying out a covert operation knows from the start that it cannot keep the activity itself its secret. It aims instead for plausible denial. Even friendly government agencies working together on international operations of these radars cannot always agree which operations like HARP or the U.S. Navy's own over-the-horizon radar are helpful and whether they should be covert or clandestine. Different countries have a different view of how effective a clandestine super radar project can be. We can take an analogy of this if we look at the question of how effective a human agent instead of a radar can be when that agent changes sides in a war in covert and clandestine operations. You'll see more information about this in link 16 when Wikipedia gives an example in the case of Anatoly Golitsyn, who was a figure of significant espionage controversy in the Western intelligence community. The military writer, General Sir John Hackett, and the former CIA counterintelligence director, James Angleton, identified Golitsyn as the most valuable defector ever to reach the West. However, the British historian for MI5, Christopher Andrew, described Golitsyn as an unreliable conspiracy theorist, a very opposite view of his talents. Ionospheric and over-the-horizon radar installations may be therefore viewed by two countries as opposite in their effectiveness against military intrusions or scientific detection. Now, another question that is more on the scientific lines is, are our ionospheric radar beacons, like HARP, reaching out too far into space? Some more extremist claims have been made that we are attracting attention outside our solar system as we change the ionosphere's composition by superheating it during these clandestine or covert operations and then labeling them as scientific experiments. It is interesting that a recent discovery of a regularly repeated radio transmission has been heard for the first time from just outside of our solar system. Scientists claim that the newly discovered cosmic beacon is a naturally occurring neutron star. Critics claim that a natural source would be more irregular and that the signal being received must instead be an artificial one created by a non-natural source as a response to the beacons of our ionospheric radar transmissions. ScienceDaily.com, a respected online source for scientific information, has a March 2, 2016 published article about these mysterious repetitive cosmic radio bursts at Link 17. Indeed, the article in Science Daily, almost but not very closely, may open this possibility in one of the sentences toward the article. Okay, so let's come back more to the mainstream thoughts and away from some of the more extreme. KY6V, I just received that unstable internet connection on my end here. May I request a signal report? Over.
Okay, I was a little distracted in the background. Say again if you can, George. Over.
Yes, sir. I just received an unstable internet connection alert on my desktop. How is my copy? Over.
Well, I guess it's running. You know, I've got four machines on the program here tonight. I lost one of the internet connections, but it's now back with me. You're doing fine, loud and clear so far. Over.
Okay, thank you, Gordon. I have two other stations saying sounds good. All right, it looks like it recovered. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate it. Okay, so let's come back to the mainstream thoughts about over-the-horizon radar and its uses. Having looked at this recent past decade of concern and criticism of super high-power radar, let's move away from the hypothetical world of the extreme and return to the central topic of scientific and observable uses of ionospheric and over-the-horizon radar installations. So we're moving from the covert back to more conventional theory here. The major types of high-power multi-antenna radars we're looking at are ionospheric, over-the-horizon backscatter, and coastal radar. Now, there are scientifically and physically observable effects of these radars from different countries and agencies. The High Altitude Auroral Research Project has a link of the Alaska HARP installation at Link 18. The HARP radar installation in Alaska points straight up at the sky, directly transmitting to the ionosphere. It was powered by a set of five 2,500 kilowatt generators driven by diesel locomotive engines. And the Alaskan HARP has been reported with the multiple configurations of antenna arrays and power levels up into the gigawatts. Now, there was a report that the Air Force shut Alaska HARP down in 2014 and transferred it to the University of Alaska in mid-2015. The cover page of that report is shown in Leak 19. It is possible, however, that the Alaska site has been reactivated, and there's more on this later and at the bottom of the link page. So let's think about how over-the-horizon radar works. Take a look at the picture of how basic OTH radar works at Link 20, and just scroll down to the third page on that Link 20. The over-the-horizon sky radar uses a signal return by a bounce off of the ionosphere instead of a direct ground wave return. Think of over-the-horizon radar without backscatter as a ping pong ball in your hand. You're going to throw it up against the room ceiling and bounce it down to the floor a few feet away from you with a backspin, bounce it back up to the ionosphere, and then back into your hand. The ping pong ball didn't just bounce over the floor surface. Instead, it bounced up, down, back up, and back home to your hand. Now, the difference between over-the-horizon and over-the-horizon backscatter is the use of the much fainter multiple-path returns from the backscatter radiation. Over-the-horizon backscatter radar will listen for the parts of the radar wave that did not return the first time, but bounced back and forth between the ionosphere and the Earth with an even smaller part of the return, then reflecting back to the radar site. I'll explain that after link reset. Think of the ping pong ball in your hand once again. This time, you have an irregular floor surface instead of a smooth floor surface. This time, when you throw the ping pong ball up and over, when it comes back and hits the floor, it's going to bounce back at an odd angle from a buckle in the surface of the floor and then bounce around the room, eventually coming back to your hand after a multi-path return with the time delays. The return just bounces all over the room and then finally comes back to you. By looking at this backscatter radiation, then over-the-horizon backscatter radar can be used to look at battlefield sites, ground terrain, search for underground installations, and maybe even find troop movements by analyzing the backscatter radiation using sophisticated high-performance computer models on supercomputers, mathematically analyzing the multiple return images, and then determining an image of the ground surface that is extracted and projected on a large screen for staff to view or plan military or civilian operations. So, Chief, will you please tell us more about the possible and even speculative military applications of over-the-horizon battlefield radar? W4RFJ from NO70. Over.
NO70, this is W4RFJ. There are several examples of the horizontal battlefield radar. One of these is possibly described in an article about the military seeing a battlefield from a windowless room by combining intelligence from multiple sources. While over the horizon backscatter, also known as OTHB radar, is not specifically mentioned, there is more than adequate documentation of surface scanning capability on the ground and in the air, and it is mentioned in military and other reputable documents. Sorry for my pronunciation. Link 20 is a good link to look at for that. Let me see, does anybody have any guesses as to how they can distinguish between everyday flight traffic and one that may be hostile in that type of environment? Please call W4RFJ.
6, Victor.
Yeah, I'm glad you said something there, Gordon. I was starting to get a complex. Go ahead.
So was I. I've got a couple of things here. It's my understanding that they use the published flight schedules for scheduled aircraft. They compare that to the incoming signal. They do a compare and contrast, and they say, hey, this one is not scheduled. It's a bogey. Let's look at it. But while we're here, I'd like to ask a question of either you or George. Have either one of you ever got into the reference material on this backscatter stuff? Is there a document available that shows you first what the CRT looks like when the backscatter is gathered? Secondly, a document that shows you the reference after it comes out of the computer's manipulation, and does it actually finally turn into a graphic display of a an island in the Pacific or whatever? I've never seen anything published, and maybe they're trying to keep it hush-hush, that takes it in that kind of depth. Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I'm clueless at South Cars right now. There was a thought that I had that I know nobody's really mentioned or talked about. Most of your aviation radar, most of your radars have a separate transceiving system called IFF. That's interrogation friend or foe. And they have specific codes that are put into these machines that identify that specific aircraft. And if that aircraft goes into your airspace without a code, then of course it's labeled hostile. But maybe George might have a better idea of answering your question there, Gordon. Go ahead there, George.
W4FJ and NO, KY6V, this is NO70. Well, regrettably, that appears to be very tightly held secrets. Rest assured, I tried to find such a display. The literature gives the impression that it may be possibly similar to an air traffic controller's scope, where it simply eliminates the return images of the known flight paths and then only has the unknown, which has been researched. It may simply get the impression, a one-line display saying, oh, here's that just prints out and they say, you need to come take a look at this. Regrettably, I was unable to find an actual display. The closest that we may come to is using waveform analysis, which may be the subject of a later TIN, that might give us some clues. But I'm afraid that I don't really have a good answer for that either, and I wish I did, but it appears to be part of the still closely held secrets. Did I answer the question, W4FJ NO70?
Well, I didn't have the question. Gordon did. Gordon, did he get it?
Yeah, I thank you for that. I was rather suspecting that some of this backscatter stuff and how it works nitty-gritty is probably a cloak and dagger and covered up. Hey, while I've got the podium, let me put out some breaking news. I just got a email in from Stephanie. Stephanie is KC2RMO's wife. It's not good news, but it's not really bad news. Let me read it to everybody. It's a good thing I haven't yet deleted the distribution list for the Gary Agnew update emails. This is Stephanie writing now. And I thought I was done with the updates on him. Gary is back in the hospital as of this morning, this time with pneumonia. The good news is the doctor said he'll be admitted for a couple of days, as opposed to a week or even longer. So we were hoping for a discharge this weekend sometime. He is being treated with a 4-Vanco, never heard of it, V-A-N-C-O, and 4-Zosyn. Talk about pronunciation. Z-O-S-Y-N. A couple of heavy-duty drugs to knock the bad P-word out of him. Let's hope that works. Ended and signed C. Stephanie that came in at 8:11 this evening. Back to you, Roger, KY6V.
Okay, Gordon. Well, we will continue to pray for our friends and family here in South Carson. Thank you very much for that information. This is W4RFJ with the TIN. And getting back to the topic, we were talking about being able to distinguish between everyday flight traffic and one that may be hostile within the over-the-horizon backscatter type of radar. If you compare an unknown radar return against a library of known object flight paths, and the one not stored in the known library is assigned an undetermined status, which could probably be done with the fast and super... Super fast. Boy, I'm really doing good tonight. With the technology we have in computing that data, there's all kinds of analysis. Here's an example, a cruise missile, an intercontinental flight object, or other aviation threat. You know, they can actually take predetermined flight paths and aircraft that's not or objects that are not flying or not going in the proper paths can be considered an issue. A discussion of how OTH or over the horizon radar can identify an object as small as a Cessna aircraft so far away for the beginner is available in an introductory Department of Defense document out of Hanscom Air Force Base written in 1992, a summary of the technical operations and language written for a basic level of radio knowledge is at link 21. So you might want to check that out. While the military strongly denies the radar has any destructive capability to aviation objects, there are many interesting parties that say increasing the radar power is capable of harming an undetermined aircraft by either interfering with the electronics, which is a good possibility, or in some extremist views, causing molecular dispersion of the substances used to build the aircraft. I'm not a scientist. I can't. I've already been forced to use bigger words than I'm used to using. So, George, I'm going to turn it back over to you, sir. Thank you very much. And we'll let you do your thing from here on. Good evening to everybody, W4RFJ.
W4RFJ and KY6V and the group NO70. Well, of course, my best wishes, and I know others expressed their wish for Gary's recovery. It's so difficult to hear that he's going through that. So thank you, Roger. Yes, the use of radar and high-power radar does have a spectrum of opinions about what it does and how best to use it. The supercomputers are definitely required for an analysis of OTHB backscatter radiation. Okay, so we're coming up to where we're going to actually be hearing some radar sounds and images. So we're going to, I think, keep moving along here, and it should... you know, you should be hearing some beeps and buzzes coming from your speakers here in a couple of minutes, okay? So, there are more ionospheric radars like HARP. They're called Dural Aurora Radio Networks, DARN. And that's pronounced SuperDARN, and that is the pronunciation of the abbreviation SuperDARN. Here's a table of Super Aurora Networks at link 22. And there is a sample ionogram of a radar return at link 22A. Now, this might be the closest to what Gordon was asking about. It's an ionogram of a radar return where you can look at the dots and then from the dots get some idea of what the return consists of. But again, it uses a supercomputer to do the final analysis and come out with the answer about what the radar is seeing. Now, ionospheric and over-the-horizon radar research is still active in 2015. The University of Leicester posts an announcement at link 23 with the Maryland SuperDARN as being mentioned. I'm wondering if any stations on the net may have visited the Wallops Island NASA facility or the Johns Hopkins University JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, facility on Wallops Island. Has anyone ever visited for vacation there? If so, please call 970. Over. Well, nothing heard. Okay, there is a reported super facility in Maryland at the GH Applied Physics Lab on Wallops Island on that skinny little peninsula of Maryland on the eastern shore. And Link 24 has an illustration of that. Chief, are you still with us to tell us more about the military and space activity at Wallops Island, W4RFJ, NO70?
Yeah, I'm still here. And I guess an added level of mystery is reported around the John Hopkins site George mentioned, because there are rocket launches from the Virginia facility that can be easily seen from the radar site. The radar site had reported 32 radars operating on frequencies between 8 and 20 megahertz and looking into the polar regions of the Earth. I think from here, Gordon will be playing the radar audios tonight from the highly secret South Car Sound Vault. I don't even know where that is. Installed just for this TIN with its own special high-capacity coffee pot. Now, that is where I am in. So, Gordon, what does the harp sound like at Link 25? KY6V, this is W4RFJ. Don't keep me waiting.
Oh, there's a lot of cloak and dagger stuff about this super compound here. We'll get into it when time permits. Give me just a moment to queue up Link 25 and we'll roll it. This is KY6V. I sort of think that would keep me up at night. Go ahead, Roger, KY6V.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you. I don't know about you, but I'm hearing a little time tick in there, you know, like what would be used to synchronize timing, a little tick, tick, tick in the background. Did you notice that, Gordon?
Yeah, I did. You know, we're going to be playing, four or five different radar installation sounds. They're all a little bit different, but you can really listen to it. You can hear the synchronization. Some of them sound awfully funny, but I guess they work. Go ahead, Roger.
Very good. Well, as far as the covert activities with South Cars, I don't even know where that secret coffee pot is. The Admiral won't tell me because she knows I'll empty it in a heartbeat. There is another Super Darn site in the United Kingdom, Super Darn UK. The homepage for the United Kingdom's high power facility is at Link 26. And the British facility had reported three upper atmospheric radars operated by the British Antarctic Survey and University of Leicester. Oh, man. Yeah. Anyway, it's at Goose Green in the Falkland Islands, Finland and Iceland. More were planned in Antarctica and the Falkland Islands. A radar coverage overlap map is available at Link 27. George will tell us more about the Sura HARP site in Russia. So, George, take it away, W4RFJ. Thanks, Gordon.
W4RFJ in the group, NO70. There's a HARP-like facility at Nizhny Novgorod, Russia, Nizhny Novgorod. It has three 250-kilowatt broadcasting transmitters operating in a range of 4.5 to 9.3 megahertz and a 144-element cross-dipole antenna array with dimensions of, get this, 300 meters by 300 meters. A maximum zenith gain of about 24 dB is reached, therefore making the ERP of the facility at Nizhny Novgorod to be 190 megawatts. Pictures of the Shura Russian antenna farm, power distribution farm, transmitter banks, control room, and RF cage are at the Russian website. See Link 28 for multiple pictures of the inside and outside of the Russian facility and even the operator, just as if you were there. There are additional pictures at the bottom of this very technical paper on the pages in between. Now, when you look at these links here, the word gallery is not misspelled in the hyperlinks. That's the Russian spelling. So it is just G-A-L-E-R-Y, Golf, Alpha, Lima, Echo, Romeo, Yankee, not two L's. So if you want to check link 28, Chura has been used to study radio wave deflection that resulted from a stream of radio energy into the ionosphere that resulted in a scattered return of signals from sources outside the pump beam, like satellites located outside the beam. A picture is located on page 3 of the following technical paper in link 28A. Please ignore the complex title and just scroll down to page 3. The picture shows a primary ionospheric pump straight up that causes a plasma duct into the atmosphere. Radio emissions coming from outside that duct reflect off of the duct in a secondary scatter that can be heard over the that can be heard on receivers located away from the vertical return path. You will notice that these scattered secondary signals can be heard over uneven terrain. We will talk more about secondary radiation and about how it is used to map ground and sea surfaces for military use later in this TIN. Now, could this Chura site be looking at your backyard without a drone overhead? A ground-level Chura antenna view is at link 29, and a picture of the Chura antenna array is at link 30. A possible off-grid power distribution picture is at link 31, and you will see a picture of the transmitter control console with the operator at link 32. Possibly the radar return analysis position is at link 33. Now, there are some practical construction requirements because these over-the-horizon radar transmitters use such high power that a receiver located at the same place as the transmitter would be swamped and the radar return cannot be heard. That's why there's always a geographical separation ranging from hundreds of feet to miles apart between the transmitting antenna and the receiver. Another interesting fact about placement of these antennae is that wind farms also can interfere with the Doppler part of the OTH radar return. Think of the Doppler weather radar that measures the speed and direction of storm fronts on your evening weather report. The same air movements from the curved blades of the wind turbine cause a reflection of the OTH radar beam that interferes with the interpretation of the radar return. The headline on the French radar website describes this at link 34. Now, the headline is in French, so I'll give you the English translation. If a wind turbine is less than 30 kilometers from a weather radar, measuring the speed of the wind carried by weather radars with the Doppler may be impaired. This alteration is based on the size of the wind turbine and the number implanted of the wind turbines, says Gerard Bubio, an engineer at ONEHA. And he continues, but that's not the only problem in the beam axis. The estimated rainfall is also disturbed by a knockout effect. So now let's move from there to Norway. The Svisi Svalbard radar in Norway is a so-called MST radar, or mesosphere, stratosphere, troposphere radar, which operates at 53.5 megahertz with only 200 watts and a duty cycle of 4%. It is located in Ventolin, approximately 10 kilometers southwest of Longyearbyen. It is a phased array with a low visual impact on the environment. The Svisi Svalbard radar has an average power up to 3 kilowatts a high-gain 356 Yagi antenna array of 95 meters diameter and five beam-pointing directions at and close to the zenith. The SWCSI website has some very specific observations for improved clear air turbulence and weather forecasting. You can see the last page of their brochure at link 36, and that is a PowerPoint presentation and worth looking at after the net.
Six, Victor.
KY6VNO7M.
Yeah, just as a little bit of information, some of the stations that have turned in or tuned in a little later than our startup, one in particular was asking where to find this link information. You might want to go through that again. Website, open the center fold and go down to click here and that kind of thing. Over.
Thank you, Gordon. Yes, KY6VNO7O. And thank you to the stations that are joining us. I appreciate your being here on the South Cars TIN. So if you will go to voip.southcars.com, that's Victor Oscar India Papa .southcars.com, and then click on the picture of the eagle in the upper left-hand side. You may already be there, and you'll see a picture about tonight's program in the center panel. Scroll down to just below that picture, and you will see where it says Read More. Click on that, and it will open up another panel that was pre-publicity, and scroll down to the bottom where it will say additional material, additional resource material. You can click on that, and that will open up another page. Let me ask if anyone needs additional information to open up the link. Please call NO70. Okay, nothing heard. If you do have trouble, please type something in the text box or call again and let us know. All right, let's move in from the One Norway site to the Tromsø site in Norway, which began operation in 1980. Sections 2.1 and 2.2 on pages 1 and 2 of Link 36A describe 1.2 megawatts from the transmitter feeding three cross dipole and other antenna arrays for an ERP of 300 megawatts. And I want to make sure we're not leaving anything behind. KF5HGU, does that mean no, you cannot find it? Does that mean that no, you're good? KF5HGU, NO70, over.
Yeah, George, NO70, KF5HGU. No, I'm good. I think I got it down from there, George. I appreciate it very much. Kind of interesting. KF5HGU, over to you, sir.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate you joining us tonight. Very good. Glad that you were able to see it. All right, so we're talking about Tromsø, the Norway site, and at link 36A, you will see more information about that site. So are we ready then now to move from Norway to Iceland? Was a HARP or Super Darn radar being used to antagonize Iceland? We're coming back to the cloak and dagger a little bit. Some residents seem to have a concern about the radar's effects in Link 37. I was unable to find any audio of that site, so we're going to move over now to Tiger Radio in Australia as we take our travel around the world here. The Tiger radar in Australia has two radars, one in Tasmania and one in New Zealand, with beams that intersect as shown in Link 38. And if you give that a second, it will show you the beams intersecting at Link 38. Now, Tiger is controlled remotely from La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, in the 8 to 20 megahertz range, consumes only 2 kilowatts of power, and transmits an average of 200 watts, about the same as two bright light globes. Now, that sounds like just a small amount of power, but I have a question. Are you fond of watching the Aurora Light Show? Tiger's direct mission is to study the southern aurora in what is excellently described with pictures of the sun's solar wind. Their website has a link on the left-hand side labeled Introduction to Tiger. If you click on that link, Introduction to Tiger, you will see on that introductory page an excellent visual graphic of how the solar wind is dispersed around the Earth. Many of you probably have seen this on a lot of scientific programs. Only a small portion of the solar wind is absorbed by the Earth's ionosphere. The remainder wraps around the Earth and creates a solar wind shadow on the side of the Earth facing away from the Sun. As the Earth's ionosphere changes, the solar wind interaction changes and creates a spectacular light show. That light show is a permanent reminder that we would not exist without the protection of the ionosphere. And it is Tiger's mission to investigate that southern aurora. The Bruni radar footprint and its sister station in Unwin, New Zealand, cover the lower latitude portion of the auroral oval and the ionospheric trough. Both have a total of 20 antennas each and 600-watt transmitters. The Unwin radar is a stereo system that actually transmits on two different sets of frequencies simultaneously at one time. Link 39 has pictures of the antenna array of the electronics equipment bank and a chart of the technical operating specifications at Unwin. So we actually do have a sample of the Unwin signal at Link 40, and the custodian in the South Cars Wave Foul Vault, KY6Z, has the recording from NO70.
Okay, are you ready for the next link, George? I'm sorry, over.
Thank you, Gordon, for asking. Yes, link 40, the Tiger 1 wavelength. Over.
Roger. Everybody stand by, please. Well, now you can tell that one had a little personality, George. Go ahead.
That's a good point, Gordon. I'd like to suggest that we noticed a difference in the woodpecker tone to the first signal we heard from Johns Hopkins. So, Gordon, would you play the Johns Hopkins signal that we heard earlier again so that net members can listen to the difference in pitch? This is Link 41, KY6V from NO70.
Roger, sir. Stand by, please. I like the last one better. Go ahead, George.
Okay, well, 6V from NO70. Thank you, Gordon. You know, there definitely is a difference between the two, each with its own purpose, I'm sure, according to the engineers of the signal. Now, at Link 41A, there's a waveform of an over-the-horizon backscatter radar just above the 15-meter band at Link 41A. It is an excellent way to learn some basics of how to read a waterfall display with time and frequency. Please notice how the waterfall appears to rise with the oldest return at the top of the waterfall. Clock time is on the y-axis instead of the x-axis, as usually used on an oscilloscope. Other waterfalls may put the newest return at the top, so the image flows toward the bottom of the waterfall. Just observe the signal's actual received frequency across the bottom of the waterfall, with the radar frequency to the left and Radio Australia's higher frequency to the right. And that's at Link 41A. I'll give you a second to pull that up. This is NO7F. Okay, so now we're going to travel to Russia and the Duga system, nicknamed the Russian Woodpecker, that's known for its distinctive rat-a-tat audio. Does anyone on the net remember hearing the Russian woodpecker? Gordon mentioned he did earlier. Anyone that's heard the Russian woodpecker, and especially back in the 80s, please call now. Oh, yes, I see some yeses. K8LF, NO70. Go ahead, please, sir.
Oh, I was just going to say I remember the woodpecker.
Thank you, Jerome. Fred, K2HA, over to you, over.
Yes, let me turn off this the sound first. That was the backscatter. And the woodpecker was very annoying. And before that, the buzzsaw, going back into the 50s, listening on shortwave and ham radio, the buzzsaws and the, it was just horrible just across the bands. Okay, back to you. This is Fred, K2HA.
Thank you, Fred, K2HF 1070. And Roger, W4RFJ, did it interfere a lot with your ham radio operation, W4RFJ from 1070?
Actually, no. I used it to prove to my kids that the Woody Woodpecker was available on ham radio. Over.
Now, that is an innovative use of over the horizon radar. I don't think I came across that in the literature. Thank you, Chief. W4RFJ and the group, 1070. This is the South Cars Thursday technical information net. Okay, so the Russian military radar, the International Amateur Radio Union monitoring system, does report increased military traffic on ham bands as recently as August of 2015 in the ARRL newsletter of September 17, 2015 at link 42, and I recommend that to your reading after that. The Duga over the horizon radar in Russia, also nicknamed Steelyard, exists, and there's a lot of different opinion about which radar, Russian radar, is Steelyard and which is not, or which was, which is. But there are reports that it exists and continually transmits on 14 megahertz with a signal heard very frequently in earlier years. It's really difficult to know without careful reading if there's an old or a new Steelyard radar, but there are definitely Duga radars. There's a pre-Steelyard Chernobyl Duga at link 43 that you can take a look at, and that's a YouTube video that you can watch after that. The reflectors inside the radar elements can be seen in link 44. Some rather daring climbers on the Russia Duga radar can be seen in link 45 in the Chernobyl radiation exclusion zone. A warning, there is one potentially offensive word about timestamp 4 minutes by the Russian narrator climber said under the stress of the visiting climb. You may find the views quite impressive. Another group of climbers tells their story in pictures in link 45A, and that's a different group of climbers. There's also a Russian radar nicknamed Container, spelled in Russian Kilo, Oscar, November, Tango, Alpha, Yankee, November, Echo, Romeo, placed in service in December of 2013, and that was scheduled to be fully operational by the end of 2015. Now, located in Kovikino, Mordovia, in western Russia, is reported to have a range of more than 1,860 miles of radar detection that can detect aircraft, unmanned aerial vehicles, and even the launch of cruise missiles. More information is available at link 46, but notice that you may have to copy and paste this link or retype it, because that aerospace defense site doesn't just go by the click. There's a picture of the Russian Container Tower Array at link 47, and Wikisig listed in a listing of signal types and links to a special page about the signal from Container in link 48. The actual Container emission, labeled as being active in 2016 by some sources at link 49, TINET members, attention please, for this link you will need to go to the page on the website and click the audio file play arrow. And we're getting close to the end here. On June 13, 2015, there was a report from the University of Twente in the Netherlands with an amateur radio group of an active Russian radar spreading noise over just about the whole 20-meter amateur band. The radar container was viewed as a possible source, and claims of interference from harp-like emissions are made by countries on both sides of the signals. In 2012, a Russian news site published an article claiming the possibility that a U.S. high-power radar emission actually downed a Russian Mars probe at Link 50. This is a Russian newscast that talks about the radar taking a Russian Mars probe down. As early as 2013, the Russian radar container was documented by a video social media contributor with an included waterfall display of the audio at Link 50A. That's a video, and it does an excellent job of walking you through a display, how to analyze a waterfall display. So, Chief, can you tell us a little bit more about the portable over-the-horizon backscatter sites, W4RFJ from NO7? Go ahead, please.
Okay, George, fine business. The portable over-the-horizon backscatter radars in the United States, there's an overview of portable over-the-horizon radars in Link 52. They actually have a piece of equipment that's using a military designation of Alpha November, which stands for Army-Navy/Fox Papa Sierra-118. Now, the FPS, I'm not sure exactly what that stands for, but it is an over-the-horizon backscatter, or OTHB radar. Six 1-million-watt radars were built for a cost of $1.5 billion to warn against Soviet bomber attacks when the planes were still thousands of miles away. The East Coast radars were located at the state of Maine's Moscow Air Force Base and Columbia Air Force Station from U.S. airspace bounce 5 to 28 megahertz waves off the ionosphere. There were 12 transmitters feeding 1 megawatt to horizontal linear phased arrays and an effective radiated power of 100 megawatts, and the receive array was 246 5-meter vertical elements and a 20-meter back screen. Let's see, I just pushed the wrong button. The West Coast facility had three sites: the Operations Center at Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, the transmitter was in Christmas Valley, Oregon, and the receiver at Tule Lake near Alturas, California. A further note, in 1991, NOAA, National Oceanographic Air Administration, considered the possibility for these old radar sites to examine the climate. Scientists looked at the non-military part of the radar echo not used by the military, specifically the ocean clutter. Further tests proved that the processed radar clutter return was effective to determine ocean wind direction over huge maritime areas. We will cover more about this in our section on coastal radar. Are there any questions from the net? This is W4RFJ. Okay, I'm glad there weren't, because that kind of got my head spinning, all those numbers. Anyway, George, will you tell us more about our special guest Craig's visit to the Tule Lake facility, NO70 from W4RFJ?
W4FJ from NO70. Thank you, Chief. Well, yeah, one of our special contributors, Craig Bass, has an interest in railroad radio transmissions and had an opportunity to visit the partially dismantled Tule Lake High Power Radar Facility. There are very interesting photos on his railroad website's radar pages and a few comments about the dismantlement of the radar facility. Craig has kindly agreed to tell us how he came across one of the formerly hidden super high-power radar sites and tell it in his own words. So here's third-party traffic for the net in Link 53 and KY6V, the keeper of the audio wavefile vault from NO70. For Craig's interest audio, please. Over.
Roger. Thank you, George. Stand by for Greg, ladies and gentlemen, from KY6A.
So how does a rail fan become interested in over-the-horizon backscatter radar? Well, I'm interested in more things than just trains. Always been interested in Cold War technology and history and things like military secrets and the whole genre there. I'm also interested in geocaching, and there's a geocache located out near this over-the-horizon backscatter radar. It's on a hill overlooking it. Back in 2006, I went out and took a look and was really impressed by the facility. I was fascinated by it. It's like 5 miles long, and it's got three different sections with 8,000 foot by 65 foot radar antenna. And I did some research when I got home and learned about it and learned how it was supposed to work and learned that it was in warm storage status and there was a caretaker. So I went out a few days later and left a note on the door for him. And I didn't expect him to call me, but sure enough, a few days after that, the caretaker called me, and after we talked for a while, he invited me out for a tour. Now, naturally, I wasn't going to turn that down. I was fascinated by the facility and what was remaining of it. The infrastructure was all still there, but everything inside the buildings was all packed up, all the computer gear and electronics in big crates ready to be trucked out. He had been there since the facility was under construction. He had some really neat photographs in a photo album he kept. And he was real proud of the generators in there, the diesel engines. He'd polished them back when the facility was active. Well, it never really was active because the Cold War was over by the time it was ready to go. Anyway, of course, he was sad to see it go. So that's how I became interested in the over-the-horizon backscatter radar system. And I really hope that they've got something better now that they've torn it down, because you never know what's going to happen in the future. I'm sure they do. They know what they're doing, right?
There you have it from Mr. Bass, George, KY6V.
KY6V from NO70. Yes, they do know what they're doing, right? I love the way you said that. I had to check something there for a moment. So there are external photos of the site that Craig Bass visited in Link 53A, and some time ago Craig visited the caretaker, as you mentioned, and the interior snapshots he took are in Link 54. Craig also mentions use of the facility to monitor weather and sea conditions in the Atlantic Ocean on his website, and describes the demolition over time of the facility. In April of 2016, Craig returned to the site almost 10 years later to take pictures of how the location looks now. He may post those on his website later, so check back on the site in a couple of months to see how civilization has treated this Cold War historic location. And also note his mention of the required geographical separation of the transmitter and receiver sites, with one at Crucis Valley, Oregon, and the other at Tule Lake, California, at Link 55. And he also references on his website a link to another site's photos of the Tule Lake facility at Link 56. Okay, so I'm now curious as to whether anyone on the net has ever visited Australia or the Cyprus Islands. Has anyone on the net visited Australia or the Cyprus Islands? If so, please call now.
Six, Victor.
Six, Victor. And what year did you visit, please, Gordon? Over.
Well, I'll have to think back. It was about 1970, possibly 1971. Spent a week in Sydney on some business. Just a beautiful country, number one. Wonderful people, number two. Hated to leave, number three. Go ahead, George, KY6V.
KY6V from NO70. Thank you, Gordon. It must be a beautiful place to go. I've never been there. Okay, so talking now then about Australia, the Generally Operational Radar Network, or JORN, I'll pronounce it JORN, is an OTHR able to monitor air and operations, wave heights, and wind directions up to 3,000 kilometers away. It is used in the defense of Australia and was or is very important to the welfare and protection of the Australian nation, just as our radars are so important to the defense of our nation. Notice the consistent first pitch and the different secondary pitches after each repeat of the first pitch in the following recording. Gordon has this particularly amusing radar audio that may be heard at Link 57. KY6V at the wave file vault from NO70. Over.
Okay. KY6V, stand by, please. That's my favorite, George. I just love the way the Aussies do it. KY6V, go ahead, sir.
KY6V, NO70. thank you, Chief. Chief always breaks me up on these nets. The British Royal Air Force, also in Cyprus, is operating the Cyprus radar and often heard on the 10, 21, and 28 megahertz amateur bands with sweep rates of 12.5, 25, and 50 sweeps per second. Those signals have a bandwidth of 20 kilohertz or more, a rather wide swath. The Turkey site, OTHR Turkey site, uses the same parameters as the Cyprus radar on 15 and 10 meter bands and is located in Ankara and southeast and west Turkey. As we listen here, please notice the more buzzing-like sound of the over-the-horizon radar compared to the pecking sound of an ionospheric beam we heard earlier for the auroral sites, and this will be at Link 58. KY6V and the Wave 5 Vault is kind enough to have that ready for us. Over to you from NO70.
Okay, make sure that I'm in sync here. You're talking Link 58, sir?
Affirmative, sir. My bad. Yes, Link 58, please, Gordon. Over.
Roger that. Stand by, please. If you listen closely, I think there was a little selective fade in there. Go ahead, George.
KY6V from NO70. You caught that beautifully, Gordon, and that is, can actually be seen on the waveform waterfall display. Let me reset the links. Okay, so now we're going to take a look at two waveforms from China. One, they're going to be similar, but a little bit different from each other. The China continuous site is often interfering with 7,080 to 7,130 kilohertz and has 43.5 sweeps per second as heard at Link 59 in the vault. KY6V or Link 59 from NO70. Over.
Roger. Stand by, please. There you have it, George, KY6V.
Thank you, Gordon. And you heard that was a more continuous sound. Now let's look at the Chinese burst system, which has a more buzzsaw-like sound, but still sounds similar to the burst radar. And this different buzzsaw sound can be heard at Link 60, KY6V from NO70.
Roger, here we go. Some of us are going to be hearing that when we're sleeping tonight. Go ahead, George, KY6.
KY6V from NO70. Yes, but of course you can hear the different. I think you're right, Gordon. That's going to be in our heads tonight. I mean, you hear the difference between the continuous and the burst. All right, so those are from China, and the homepage for the Chinese Arctic and Antarctic Administration is at Link 61, which began research in 1991 with a five-year plan. And some of the study headings included research on solar terrestrial behavior, as we've also talked about earlier. After the Yellow River Station was established in 2004 in Svalbard, there is a list of some projects in the last paragraph for 2004-2006. Now, the Chinese ionospheric results in the Xiankang region are included in an IEEE Year 2000 Proceedings book that you can find at Link 62. The Israelis also have an over-the-horizon radar with a new type of radar that actually shows on the waveform analysis as a sawtooth wave across the entire face of the sonogram. Very interesting, and you'll have to do some research on the web because that's another link that's disappeared. The Iranian radar, one in Iran, has a pronounced high-frequency burst. It sounds like an old tin clock interspersed with lower frequency pulses on 14 and 21 megahertz M band and international broadcast frequencies. Gordon has this very interesting pattern as heard at Link 63, KY6V from NO70.
Roger, stand by, please. There you have it, George, and I'm laughing. You should see the comment that W4RFJ put in the text box. Back to you.
KY6V from NO70. Yeah, that's why I've been having a little trouble the last few times. Chief always cracks me up here, so I think the comments are extremely pertinent to these sounds. France also has Nostradamus radar, which is an off-the-ionosphere bounced radar wave that talks about detection of aircraft, like we were talking about earlier in the program. At Link 64 in a video graphic. And there's a picture of one tract of 96 trans-horizon Nostradamus antennas at Link 65. That tract is nicknamed Diablo. Nostradamus has been reported to have 288 transmitter aerials on several hundreds of meters. There's also the Franz Graf site that does surveillance of satellites up to 1,000 kilometers in altitude at Link 66. Now, that is a French language website, but you should be able to pick out the photos there. So let's take a quick look at other worldwide over-the-horizon radars. There are other over-the-horizon radars affecting HF reception that we just do not have time to explore, but you are encouraged to search on your own for over-the-horizon radar. Even the foreign language websites, such as in French and German, have enough technical language roots that you may be able to read the technical specifications with just a little bit of patience. We had scheduled coastal radar. There are links out there to look at, but rather than make the net go too long tonight, then I'll refer that to you, and Gordon and I will talk later about the other remaining links. But I do want to, while the net is in session, ask you to scroll down, if you would, to some after the net tonight fun that you might enjoy. If you will scroll down to Link 70, everyone on the net. Let me just pause here and ask if there's any station on the net that's having trouble finding Link 70. Please call NO70. Over. Nothing heard. Okay, so I want to call your attention to just a couple of enjoyable things that I wanted to put in that supplements the discussion of over-the-horizon radars, their use in political and international relationships, struggles, in all of the factual and maybe lighthearted and even fictional looks here. Link 70 is a 1950s-style documentary that was put out about the radar defense systems in the 1950s. It's a very dated link, but it does talk about how the systems worked to protect our nation in the 1950s when we could, quote, see the enemy before the enemy sees us, unquote. Don't believe it. See Link 70. And the subject of radar jamming of HF communications can be seen in the U.S. Navy document entitled Defensive Electronic Countermeasures from a May 1962 U.S. Navy training film at Link 71, which is a video. For those of you that are interested in very early ham radio activities, there's a Schwarzenberg radio facility that was a very early long-wave transmission facility active as early as 1929 and a precursor to today's over-the-horizon radar. And that information is at Link 72 with pictures of the transmitter and cabinet and employee roster inside the facility at Link 72A. There is an animated worldwide tour of super facilities in a video at Link 73, and then a discussion of the revitalization of Alaska HARP when its future was very much in question at Link 74, which again is a video. So that's our introduction to HARP and over-the-horizon and coastal and surface radar for tonight. We encourage you to spend some time on your own to find out which parts of today's presentation are most interesting to you, and then to explore for your own interest. Remember, the next time you hear these signals on your favorite ham band, you will be better informed about the source of the transmissions from having heard the wave files. You may even be able to tell what country they came from because of what you've learned on the South Cars Net here tonight. And you may even be able to apply some current international relations knowledge in the news to what you're hearing on the ham band, which adds an added dimension to your ham radio pleasure and enjoyment. Okay, I'd like to take just a moment to make you aware of some very entertaining videos for you to look at now that we concluded the formal part of the presentation. For those of you that are aware that the purpose of over-the-horizon radar is detection of military threat, including intercontinental nuclear devices, then there is a very entertaining and thought-provoking time-lapse video of nuclear tests where it starts out really slow at the beginning of testing, and it's amazing how many nuclear explosion tests worldwide occurred, and that's at Link 76. You can take a quiz about how much you know about international spies and number stations, which go into the clandestine that we talked about earlier in the net at Links 77 and 78. You can tell how good a spy you might have been or are. And at Link 79, we have a dying scientist that fires a missile into the Earth center and nearly blows the planet apart with high power bombs again. And then speaking of the bombs that Over the Horizon radar is designed to detect, the first British nuclear bomb can be seen at Link 80. Now, for those of you who are really interested in international relationships that coincided with the time of listening to these over-the-horizon radars on a ham band, a very contemporary, modern, and enjoyable movie is the Bridge of Spies movie starring Tom Hanks and directed by Steven Spielberg. The UPC code is given on the links page. There's a trailer at Link 81, and they were trading spies to get U-2 plane pilot Gary Powers back from the Soviet Union after Powers' spy plane was shot down from an altitude the U.S. thought was above the Soviet Union's anti-aircraft missile ceiling, that is possibly available for checkout at your local library or bookmobile. So I know this was a very highly technical presentation tonight, and I wanted to make sure and include in this some fun and dessert for all of you NET members. Okay, we have gone like at a supersonic speed. The information available that has become declassified recently is just amazing. I want to open it up even as late as it is for any questions that might be here or any comments. Please call NO70. Over.
I have a quickie for you, George. Six, Victor.
Thank you, Gordon. KY6V, NO70.
Yeah, I just wanted to get the flavor of your recording. Did it look like it was solid? Of the four machines I had recording tonight, two of them had burps, and two of them were solid. So I think we're in pretty good shape. How are you? Over.
Gordon, I have I'm still showing the recording in process. I'm not able to actually see right now the file here. I did receive some unstable internet connections, but I will look at that. And looks like N1VXP, Rick has a comment. While he comments, I'll also check my file folder. N1VXP, NO70, over.
This is N1VXP. Great, informative net. Just thought I'd bring it to your attention. I've had an experience. This goes back, I guess say early 70s. I was working for a defense contractor up in Connecticut. And it was, I'll put it this way, it was working for Electric Boat or General Dynamics building submarines. But I was working in the more of a maintenance division that was actually overhaul and repair of five Navy living barges. And right across the river from us was the underwater sound lab, which was also doing testing, development, both sonar and radar. And I had a couple of experiences where working in the barges was no problem as long as we stayed above water. But there were some days and some hours they did not want us to go down below because they were doing testing. And I thought that was kind of strange, but they wanted to go below on those particular days and hours. And one time I did, and I heard a similar type sound. Let me drop for a second. You know, I had the wrong date. I thought it was the next day. I found out it was that day. We're not supposed to be down there. And I went down below, and just when I was about ready to go up, back up, I heard that same particular radar sound, only this was underwater. I was like, whoa. I said, uh-oh, I'm in the wrong place. I got to get out of here. I went running up the steps, up the ladder, and one of the sailors said to me, he says, what happened? So I was down there. I shouldn't have been down there. He said, oh, don't worry. I said, yeah, but they told us not to be down there under those conditions. So it was kind of a life-awakening experience, but it was not the first time that we were told, do not go down to your lower area on certain days, and we will let you know the days and the times. And we felt we were always so aggravated because we had these guys telling us what we couldn't do. We had our own work that had to be done. And we felt like why should we listen to them? But now I hear about it, I kind of think, well, there was some things they were trying to keep secret. And apparently, they might have been trying to use some of those radar signals underwater to see how they could travel. Anyway, great experience, great net. Always learn something new here on South Cars and enjoy it. And 1PXP back to net control.
N1VXP from NO70. Rick, I really appreciate your taking the time to make the comments that you have. And that's a very interesting first-person account. And interesting how, in retrospect, you put what may have been two to two together to get four. So I've learned something from that as well, too. I'd love to hear any other comments here before we close it down for the night. Please call NO70. Over. Okay, well, nothing heard. So this has been the South Cars TIN for April. I want to thank each and every one of you net members who are present tonight, who had to leave early, but for those of you that will also be listening in the future on the podcast, we sure went through a lot of material real fast at a jet speed level, and you have been fantastic in hanging in there with us and following through. Again, I want to thank all of our contributors, editors, script scrubbers, non-ham radio editors, content providers. This has been such a special privilege to be able to be a part of this tonight. And I'm looking forward to going back and digging even more myself into a lot of these reference materials. And I would be thinking about the part each of you had to play in tonight's South Cars TIN. Thank you. All right. So last call for any other comments before we close the net. Please call NO70. Nothing heard. W4RFJ from NO70. Over.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I just wanted to thank you while the net members are here and in person to say thank you for your contributions. I know you've had a very aggressive schedule, and for your being here and being a backup and for providing the expertise that you provided during the net tonight. So thank you, W4RFJ from NO70.
Oh, no. I was just backup. That's you. You and Gordon put most of the work into this, and I appreciate being allowed the honor of taking part and helping out. It's all been fun. Thank you very much, George, and back over to you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. KY6V, NO70, same. I want to thank you as well. And, you know, you definitely deserve the title of Editor Extraordinaire, Chief Bottle Washer, and Script Scrubber. So thank you, and of course, for being the WAVEFOWL coordinator, too. And I want to say good night to you, and also Kathy K6SUN, the net manager. Thank you both for all the time and efforts and the hours. I want to call the net's attention to all that you've done. And net, KY6V and K6SUN deserve a standing ovation. Okay. Have I embarrassed you sufficiently, Gordon? KY6V and 070.
Well, you're a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you, George. You know, you did the yeoman share of all of this. We were very happy to participate where we could. Good night, everybody. We'll try and get this thing posted probably sometime tomorrow. What have we got here, George? We've almost got 2.5 hours. That ought to be a neat editing job before we publish. KY6V to NO70.
Thank you, sir. So good night to you and to Kathy as well. I'm sure with Kathy's teaching schedule, I won't embarrass her by asking her now. She's probably, I hope she's resting well. Okay, so, and to each and every net member, again, thank you. This has been South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Society, with the April edition of the TIN. a network designed to help us radio amateurs and all shortwave listeners and electronics enthusiasts worldwide to enjoy our hobby, learn more about each other, have camaraderie, have fun, and look at the worldwide perspective of ham radio. Thank you for being here with us tonight. This concludes tonight's South Cars TIN, and we are returning the equipment to normal amateur operation. This is NO70, clear.
This is W4RFJ. I'd like to lodge a complaint.
Did my coffee delivery miss W4RFJ NO70, or were you looking, or should I point it over to Gordon over?
Well, you know, there's a couple of times you called the captain over there the chief bottle washer. I thought he was the captain bottle washer. Over.
Yeah, he's the captain bottle washer, but not Navy chief. Like, but you're right. You're right. I'm going to have to watch that, make sure I get that straight. So, okay. Yep. Well, hey, 2.5 hours, I tell you, by the time I'm going to have to really untie this tongue tonight, especially after some of those foreign names, chief, W4RFJ NO70.
Well, George, you did a great job. My hat's off to you, shipmate. Bravo, Zulu, all that other happy Navy stuff. You did a great job, and thank you for allowing me to be part of it. I really did enjoy it. Now I got to go to bed because I got to get up early and go whip some people into shape. W4RFJ.
Keep her running right on the tracks and not off, Chief. W4RFJ NO70.
Yeah, thanks, Raj. Have good slumber. Appreciate what you did. George beat me to the push to talk. I was going to come back when you broke water there and tell you that the complaint desk was third door to the left. See ya, Chief. KY6V clear.
Okay, I can appreciate that, Gordon. I certainly can. If you guys feel the earth move tonight, that's me hitting my bunk. See ya, W4RFJ. I'm calling taps. See ya.
Good night, Rod. Good night, everybody. KY6V clear.
Good night, John boy. W4RFJ out.